Today on the 21st, Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan joins us to talk about why she thinks survivors of childhood sexual assault should get more time to come forward to report what happened to them. The budget crisis has forced Chicago State University to lay off a third of its workforce. What's that mean for movement on this stalemate and Governor Rauner? Last week, he was booed at another college campus, the University of Illinois.
Once we get through our budget crisis in Springfield, I look forward to getting significant more funding for the University of Illinois.
Could we have movement on a state budget? We'll explore that possibility. And finally, a YouTube video created by two Chicago sports reporters has launched an international conversation about the harassment women face online.
Hopefully this skank Julie DeCaro is Bill Cosby's next victim. That would be classic.
I don't know what to say to that.
We'll talk about that kind of harassment. That's all this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last week, former House Speaker Dennis Hastert was sentenced to 15 months in federal prison. He was accused of sexually abusing teenage boys 3 decades ago when he was a high school wrestling coach at Yorkville High School in Illinois. Hastert pleaded guilty to lying to investigators and to bank fraud for transactions to pay off a man for past transgressions. If he had been convicted of sexual misconduct with a minor, he would have faced a much longer sentence than 15 months, 3 to 7 years in state prisons. But the statutes of limitation for criminal sexual misconduct had already expired. Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan is using this case as an example of why sexual assault survivors need more time to report crimes committed against them as children. And she's on the line with us today to talk about it. Attorney General Madigan, welcome to the 21st. Thank you so much for being with us.
Nyla, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
First off, I guess maybe we should explain to people, what is the current state of the law in Illinois regarding statute of limitations for children who are victims of sexual assault?
So the current state of the law is that the statute of limitations, if you were sexually assaulted or sexually abused as a minor, from the time you turn 18, you have 20 years to report. There are some circumstances under which there is no statute of limitations, and that would be a circumstance when you actually have some sort of physical evidence. In those circumstances, there is no statute of limitations. Yet, as you pointed out in your opening, we saw last week a very clear example of why having any statute of limitations for these terrible crimes really is an injustice, both for the victims, I think, as well as for society at large, who looks up and says, here is somebody who was obviously in a position of authority over these students, and when they were at school and he was their coach, and then obviously ascended to some of the highest level of our society as Speaker of the House, who then years and years and years later admits in open court that he has committed these crimes, and yet even when these people come forward, there's nothing that the law can do to hold this individual accountable and to seek justice for the victims of his terrible crimes.
What specifically are you calling for?
What I'm calling for is an elimination of the statute of limitations in Illinois on criminal sexual assault and sexual abuse of children. Because in very few circumstances is a child going to have any sort of physical evidence. Unfortunately, and nobody wants to deal with this terrible reality, there are not a few, but every single year, there are thousands and thousands of children just in our state alone who are victims of sexual assault and sexual abuse. The last year, when the statistics came out from the Child Advocacy Centers, they said that over 10,000, it was actually 10,241 children were referred to them. And they are the entities that, do the interviews and the investigations of these crimes when they take place in a, victim, survivor-sensitive manner. And so when you hear that number, I think it, really says to most people, wow, because nobody wants to believe it.
Well, and it is. It's such an awful number. And I think you're right. Nobody wants to believe that it's that number. And certainly it's a difficult conversation to have to acknowledge that this is happening. But what I want to ask you about the concept of the statute of limitations and why they were originally put in place as a safeguard. And I think it's because the legal kind of reasoning behind that is because We see that sometimes witness testimony can be less reliable over time. People, you can't find them.
Correct.
And so right now, I know the law already extends beyond the traditional statute of limitations, specifically when it comes to sex crimes against children. So how do you protect the integrity of the process for the victim and the accused if we remove those limits entirely? How would you propose we do that?
Well, you're correct in pointing out that obviously as time goes on, it becomes more and more difficult to actually prove that a crime took place in a credible manner. But understand that eliminating the statute of limitations, which truthfully, historically, they didn't exist. They were put in place over time. And so now we're kind of seeing, you know, as people often liken it, you know, the pendulum swings in the opposite direction. But we're not saying that there wouldn't still have to be an investigation and there wouldn't have to be a prosecution. In addition to which, we're not saying that by eliminating the statute of limitations, we're going to see a flood of allegations being brought that will result in criminal convictions. But what we are saying is that there will not be an arbitrary cutoff. So to use last week's example, you have Scott Cross, who in open court for the first time admitted that he was victimized by former Speaker Hastert. Hastert essentially saying, you know, yes, I committed these crimes. A judge saying, you're a serial child molester, but because of the running of the statute of limitations, I can't hold you accountable for those crimes. I can't sentence you because of those crimes. And so we see a circumstance where it appears that 19 years after the end of, even if the current statute of limitations was in place at the time, nothing can be done.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is both a miscarriage of justice as well as a problem for the victims, many of whom, most of whom, truthfully, never come forward to law enforcement, a very, very small percentage. It's in the range of maybe 10 to 15% ever come forward. But when they do, we shouldn't arbitrarily look up and say, I'm sorry, but your time has run out, particularly when you have a circumstance where you may have a perpetrator, such as you did last week, who admits to these crimes.
And regardless, even if this does happen, I think it's important to point out to people this can't be retroactive.
Correct.
If you change the law now.
Correct. It would not be retroactive. The way that these changes work when there is an extension, and the history over the last 5 to 10 years across our country has been to either extend or eliminate statutes of limitations, particularly when it comes to sex crimes. If there is still a statute of limitations that is, you know, that hasn't run, if statute of limitations gets extended, that can be picked up. But if it's already run for a certain individual, for a certain crime, it cannot be then, you know, further extended if it has already ended.
Attorney General, given what you've said, certainly the powerful and really emotional testimony that we heard last week and the reaction that we've had, I wonder what you've heard in the past couple of days since last Thursday, since you've asked lawmakers to think about changing this. Have you heard back from them?
I have, and they've been very supportive. You know, unfortunately, sometimes it takes these very high-profile, shocking situations for us to look up and say, oh, we do have a problem because of the statute of limitations. And I think we're also learning, again, you know, over the past decade or maybe even more, you know, more and more about the psychology of what happens to somebody, particularly when they're a child and victimized, and why it's so important that as part of that healing process, as part of hopefully being able to rebuild their lives, people are given the opportunity when they're finally comfortable to do so, to come forward to law enforcement, have them believe that the crime took place, have them investigate, and have that individual held accountable. You know, for children, when these crimes take place, the perpetrators are usually adults that the child and the family knows. They're obviously in a position of authority, a more powerful position certainly than the child. And, you know, too often we see it's a coach, it's a teacher, it's a troop leader, it's a priest. Maybe it's your uncle, maybe it's a step-parent. It's somebody who you know, it's somebody you may be related to. And children are so compromised in that situation, you know, not just physically, but emotionally.
And that said, I wanted to ask you just one last question. We just have about a minute left. But
sure.
For all of the people who are listening, as you said, all of those cases who aren't reported, for survivors of sexual abuse out there, what would you want to say to them right now?
I want to say to them, it's not your fault. we will believe you, and there are resources available. There are wonderful groups of advocates and organizations throughout the state of Illinois that if you are ready to come forward and you need help, please do so, and they will be there to help. These are horrible crimes that disrupt and destroy too many people's lives, and what we're trying to do is make sure that we can help those individuals move forward with their lives.
Attorney General of Illinois Lisa Madigan on why she thinks the statute of limitations need to be changed, particularly for sexual assault against minors. Thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome, Nyla. Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. On Sunday, the University of Illinois and the Tenure Faculty Coalition reached a tentative agreement on a 5-year contract ending some strike actions on the U of I campus. The contract will improve job security for non-tenure track faculty and includes increases in pay. A vote to ratify that is scheduled for later this week. As many universities are moving towards having these large amounts of non-tenured faculty, we wanted to talk about what that means, not just for the universities and for faculty members, for students. Joining us now from his office in Chicago is labor professor Bob Bruno. He teaches at UI. UC. Bob, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, it's nice to be on. Thank you.
Where does the University of Illinois compare with other universities in the system by reaching an agreement with non-tenure faculty as it did yesterday?
Well, speaking just of public universities in Illinois, the UIUC campus really is a laggard in comparison. For example, faculty, both full-time tenure and full-time non-tenure at UIC have actually gone through 2 bargaining rounds. So they've actually got 2 contracts already. And quite a few non-tenure and tenured faculty bargaining units have existed at 7 other public universities for some time.
So how has that worked at UIC? If they've had those contracts in place, would you say that that those agreements are working out?
Well, by all accounts, they seem to be working out just fine. During the contract talks at UIUC, the sister bargaining unit at UIC submitted some data, metrics on how well people have coexisted under the initial contract, and very few, if any, problems were reported, either by the administration or by the faculty unit. And that is common with these bargaining units at other universities, both here and in other states.
Well, Bob, would you say this is sort of, I don't know if we want to use the phrase new normal or what you want to use to describe the amount of non-tenured faculty we're seeing across public and private university systems? Would we say that that's becoming much more of a norm?
Yes, most certainly. It's dramatic, the change. Roughly 73% of all of the teaching faculty at public universities in the United States are in non-tenured.
73%.
73%.
Wow.
Teaching faculty are in non-tenured categories, and of the faculty that is then non-tenured, roughly 41% of those hold only part-time status. In fact, no more than 8% of faculty are in junior tenured track lines, meaning assistant professors, or in the pipeline to become tenured.
What's the difference between then adjunct faculty and non-tenure track faculty? Is there a significant difference there?
Yeah, there is. Adjunct faculty typically are teaching on a course-by-course basis. They're paid a flat fee for the course. They may teach one class one semester, 2 classes another semester. They're almost like on-call employees, and then they put together a patchwork career doing a course here and a course there at different universities. But they have really no expectation of employment. But full-time, non-tenured faculty, like the folks at UIUC, have full employment. They are salary employees. They go through an annual review, and assuming that annual review is positive, they have some expectation of being hired back. And in fact, the vast majority of them are teaching for 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years or more.
Bob, as we see these more, I don't know if you want to call them tenuous employment arrangements. And I'm thinking, again, against the backdrop of the current budget crisis that we're facing for state universities in Illinois. Where does this leave the university faculty and students as we see sort of this trend, as you said, with the vast majority of faculty being non-tenure?
Yeah. So if about 40, you know, percent of the teaching is really being done by this non-tenured faculty, there has to be some concern about the level of teaching performance, the educational experience on behalf of the student, retention rates, graduation rates, placement rates, and when the state of Illinois or other states continue to further squeeze the resources given to state universities, it makes it hard, both on the faculty and the administration, to invest in long-term full-time employees. And that raises questions, of course, about the impact on students. And so, you know, it really behooves the parties to think of creative ways really to work together, because if this is going to be the infrastructure of the labor market in higher ed for the foreseeable future, you know, the parties are going to have to find ways to manage with less resources, but at the same time really invest in professional development. And there are ways to do that without spending, you know, enormous sums of money.
Looks like lots of ways to do that. We'll be exploring that issue further. Thank you so much for joining us. Bob Bruno is the director of the Labor Education Program at UIUC, joining us from his office in Chicago. Thanks, Bob.
Yeah, you're welcome, Nada. Take care.
Up next, More Than Mean. That's a series of videos of men reading some of the disgusting online comments sent to women. Now that it's gone viral, what's next? What will it take so it's not acceptable to attack women online? We'll talk about that coming up. Stay with us. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, generating new knowledge and developing and evaluating new technologies and methodologies to better distribute scholarly knowledge. The University Library at Illinois.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've all heard about harassment that especially women face online, but a video posted last week by two female Chicago sports reporters really brought this issue into clarity. In August of last year, Julie DeCaro wrote for CBSChicago.com about allegations of rape against Chicago Blackhawks star Patrick Kane. Although she emphasized the allegations were just that, allegations, she was critical of the discussion in the media and among Blackhawks fans online, who blamed Kane's accuser before much about the situation was known. Then DeCaro faced a severe and abusive backlash on social media. Illinois Public Media's Brian Moline spoke to her about it last fall.
There's always been, you know, the guys who say, like, you know, I hope someone kills you, or you should be raped, or someone should rape your dead corpse, kind of stuff. But they're just kind of, you know, few and far between, and it's easy to just block those guys and kind of go on with your day. But when I started talking about Patrick Kane and wasn't saying what a certain group of fans think I should be saying about it, it sort of just came in a deluge, and it was like a nonstop kind of thing where, you know, every day for, you know, 10 days a week, whatever, I would just have all these threats one after another. And usually they would delete them, you know, and they weren't all threats. A lot of them were just like, this is what I hope happens to you. And some of them were a little more specific and a little more frightening, but it just came kind of, you know, one after another, after another, after another. And they had sort of their own little echo chamber going and their own little organized campaign. And I just hit the point where I just had enough.
Last week, DeCaro, who's with the Chicago radio station 670 The Score and ESPN's Sarah Spain, posted a video online that they created using the hashtag MoreThanMean. And I should note for our audience, this is tough to listen to, and for younger listeners, not appropriate for their ears. This audio is about a minute long.
All right, you ready to do some mean tweets?
I'm ready.
Sarah Spain sounds like a nagging wife on TV today.
Not even married yet.
Julie DeCaro is a run-of-the-mill, mediocre beat writer.
Not atrocious, not good.
Just sort of there.
I'm actually not a beat writer at all, but okay.
Sarah Spain is just a scrub muffin.
I don't even know what a scrub muffin is.
I don't either.
I love muffins.
One of the players should beat you to death with their hockey stick.
Like the whore you are.
Unbelievably, it gets worse.
So I have to read all of them, right? Because, I mean, I don't...
Read them, I guess.
I hope you get raped again.
Oh.
Hopefully this skank Julie DeCaro is Bill Cosby's next victim. That would be classic.
I don't know what to say to that.
I don't...
Yes, that's awkward silence, I mean, for all of us when we watch this, right? That video has been viewed more than 3 million times since it was posted last Tuesday. And we thought we would bring some more women in Illinois media into this conversation to talk about, now that this video is out there, what it means. So I want to welcome to the 21st Amy Guth. She's a journalist. She's a host of WGN Radio. She's the president of the Association of Women Journalists of Chicago and producing a documentary about all of this. Amy, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And I also want to welcome Lovey Ajayi. She's an author and writer. She's actually where I first saw this video because she posted it on Facebook. She's the author of I'm Judging You, a writer and speaker and blogs at Awesomely Lovey. Hey, Lovey, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
I wanted to ask both of you, Lovey, let's start with you. What did you think of when you first saw this video?
I was appalled. It was hard to watch because seeing these women listen to these words, these like hateful words sent at them. But one thing that I was looking at was just the men and how their discomfort as they read it back to the women, mm-hmm. and them kind of shifting their seats and understanding that this is what is happening and being in the position of being the one spewing the hate. It kind of encouraged me a little bit because they felt so uncomfortable in doing it.
Amy, what did you think?
You know, right away, I agree. It was obviously, it turned my stomach. It's a vile video. Unfortunately, it's very typical. It's something that we, female journalists, that we see almost every day for most of us, not just in sports, but in a lot of different areas of coverage. What really struck me was that how interestingly, it was very interesting to me that it resonated so deeply with so many millions of people. And I can't help but wonder if that was because men were reading them, because I think this is something women have talked about amongst ourselves for years. You know, this is really, since Twitter began, but especially in the last few years, we've been talking about this amongst each other quite a bit. And it's interesting to me that when we kind of confront a man with this and it sort of forces him to decide very quickly, are you an ally or not? And I think that was very interesting and very powerful. And I think that's a lot of what helped it resonate with so many millions of viewers.
That's Amy Guth. We're also speaking with Lovey Ajayi. And those of you listening, I want to invite you into this conversation as well, whether you're male or female. If you've seen this video, what did it make you think? Or just what you've just heard right now. If you have a story you want to share with us, you can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet us to 21st Show. That's 21st Show. On Facebook, if you like the 21st Show, you can comment. Willow said that, wow, how brutal was those mean tweets. But then Willow said, I also got to observe myself feeling sorry for those male readers, which was such an interesting experience. And I think Amy speaks to what you were saying. And I wanted to ask you, especially in terms of being president of the Associated Women Journalists in Chicago, you are also on the radio on WGN. And I have to say, I feel like I've gotten some nasty things thrown at me, but nothing on the level of this at all. It's normally just people who don't like my voice. And I want to ask both you, Lovey, and Amy. Amy, let's start with you. You think, and I think this is an important thing that you want to note to people, this doesn't just happen to female sports reporters, right, Amy?
Absolutely. This is really something that happens to most women on the internet, outside of journalism even, women with a public voice. But interestingly, and this is something I'm exploring in my documentary, there are many historic examples of backlash against women's voices. So there's a systemic piece of this that we really can't deny, that is cultural, that really transcends just the medium and was there long before the medium. The issue is that it's playing out in a much faster and crueler way because the laws have not caught up with this. It's still a bit of the Wild West. It's getting there, but we're not there yet. So I do think there's a law enforcement education piece to this. I think there's a legislative piece to this. But I also think there's an inherent tension. As a journalist, I'm all for freedom of speech, obviously. And so while we have the right to say whatever we want, that's often where the conversation ends in this narrative on this issue, because it ends and we don't continue the conversation into talking about, just because you have the right to say something doesn't mean you are absolved of the consequences of saying it. So with right comes responsibility, and the responsibility part is where we haven't caught up, and I think that's where we really need to put quite a bit of attention, really.
And I think that's a really interesting point, Amy. I was just thinking the poet laureate Juan Felipe Herrera was on the show on Friday, and he was talking about this, and he was saying people have the right to say what they want, but other people have a responsibility to step up and say this is not appropriate. Lovey, you are in this space. You're in the blogging space. When you posted this originally, I got the sense that this is something that you two have also experienced online.
Well, so part of the, to go back to the video in terms of like why they kind of pick sports journalists, I think the importance of that is that some of these sports journalists, being women, they're looked at as encroaching on a male space. Mm-hmm. So for the men who are attacking them, they also feel like they're trying to protect this machismo space, and what's a woman doing even given any type of ideas about sports. So that's one angle of it. But in terms of the internet, yeah, absolutely, the internet is full of hate, and some of the men who replied back to, well, actually one man in particular who replied back to my thread was like, well, there's a lot of hate online and it's not just to women. But people need to be very clear that there's different types of hate that you get online based on who you are. So women get the sexism, black women get the sexism or racism, men get told any type of like mundane thing about physicality, but like for us, very pointed. Usually women get the rape jokes and the I'm gonna hurt you jokes and the jokes that are supposed to make us feel threatened as females. So that's one thing that's like, you know, definitely apart from how men get approached online.
Go ahead, Amy.
That's absolutely true. That's a really great point, and I want to expand on that a little bit, because especially in sports and political areas of media, what we see often is that when men are attacked online, because to be clear, men are not free from criticism online or trolling or hatred online at all. But it is almost always about the point that the man is making. It is about the content of what he is saying. And for women, it almost always, content, the point that she's making is usually the trigger, but the result is almost always about her body, about her race, about her sexuality. It's very, but almost always it becomes very violent and very sexual. And that can begin with just like, stupid point, you dumb slut. You know, I mean, it can start with things like that, but can escalate
then it really,
so terribly so quickly.
That's Amy Guth. We're also speaking with Lovey Ajayi. And you, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to 21st Show. Let's go to Kitty in Springfield. Hey, Kitty, welcome to the 21st. What story did you want to share with us?
Well, this type of thing has been happening to me also, but it doesn't happen just to people in sportscasters. It can also happen to people in private industries. I own my own business. I own a restaurant. And I've been in business for probably 40 years with two different restaurants. Over the years, people have, you know, not had butted heads with me over calling me names. We used to have more of an alcohol place. And they still bring this up. And they go online, they call me names, they threaten to beat me up, they incite other people to beat me up. They go online and say that I need to be put out of business. I had a guy that actually hit me. And then everybody went online and go, I wish I'd been there to see that.
Wow. That's...
So it's not just in the sportscaster industry. It's just a mob mentality of whatever anybody agrees with, they're just going to get on there and feed off of it.
Kitty, when it got to the point of also the physical, I imagine you involved, did you involve the police at that point?
Yes, we had the police, but of course there was their side and then there was my people. And the police said, we're not going to go any further with this.
Thanks for sharing your story, Kitty. Amy, to your point about law enforcement and about what education needs to happen around this issue, I wonder if you can maybe, I wonder also if this video has sort of helped move the conversation a little bit in terms of education and what people need to know about it.
I think it is starting to. I think it certainly didn't hurt. It certainly got a lot of people talking about this. But really, the truth of the matter is, the first line of defense of law enforcement, if you go to pursue, you know, if you get some threatening tweets or something, or you know, some sort of threat online, and you take it to the police station, generally the first, your first point of contact is not part of a cybercrime division. And so there really needs to be some widespread education, because frankly, when this happened to me, I went through an ordeal online that was really quite threatening, quite violent, quite scary. What I received back from law enforcement was like, well, you are a good-looking lady. Why don't you get off of Twitter? What do you expect?
That's what they actually said to you?
Right. And so it was really, it was, you know, it was very dismissive and very, very, you know, it really was made clear to me there was not going to be anything done, even though there were some direct threats made to me. And I think really that really gets to the crux of this, that there is a very dangerous narrative around this, that here is normal behavior. And men, some men are really dangerous. And if you can't handle it, you need to adjust your behavior. We need to go over here. We need to not be online. We need to not fully participate as digital citizens. And to me, that's the problem. Because what happens then when people start opting out is that we're going to be left with the loudest and the meanest controlling the public narrative and essentially writing history at that point. And so to me, this is really not only a public health issue, but it's a civil rights issue.
Lovey, how do you handle this online? Lovey, are you there? Oh, it looks like we lost her. Amy, wonder you raised, I wonder if we can talk about your documentary a minute, because you raised about more than $50,000 a few months ago to do a film about online harassment and what women faced.
Right. Right. I went to Kickstarter as well as a couple of private funding sources and raised funding to do at least two seasons of an episodic documentary. It originally was going to be a 90-minute documentary, but as I dove into the issue deeper and deeper, it became more and more apparent to me that it was going to be impossible to put both, say, snark as the default language of the internet in the same breath as very, very serious things like revenge porn, like doxing, which is the practice of putting someone's personal information out on a public forum online for the purpose of allowing harm to come to them or encouraging harm to come to them. And so I really just felt like those were so different and there were so many nuances to this. And as I started reaching out across the country, quickly international stories came to me. And I realized there were cultural attitudes in other parts of the world that were very different than our own. And so quickly this became an episodic documentary grouped by topic, because I really wanted to dig deeply into many different topics around this. And it's been a really fascinating experience so far.
What's the time frame for when, I know you were just in South Africa. Are you going to, when can we see more about this?
Well, I expect the trailer over the summer, probably towards late summer, and then I'll be releasing the episode starting in late fall, early winter. And I hope to have a few out at a time so people can binge watch if they so desire. But I really want to do it very thoughtfully and have, you know, events and discussion both online and offline around each episode and really have some community-building pieces to this, because we tend to all get outraged about something and then we drop it until it happens again, and then we get outraged again, but there's no real meaningful action. So my goal here is not just to show what's going on and reach across the aisle. I'm collecting stories from many different people with many different opinions on this and many different experiences with this. But I also really think it's very important to look at what are people doing about this, and what is the end goal, and where's the next step, and what do we need to do to get there to see the internet a more civilized place? Because
Amy, you'll have to come back when you are closer to that, and we'll have a longer conversation about it. How does that sound?
Definitely.
All right. Amy Guth is, you can catch her on WGN. You can also find her. We're going to tweet out, if you follow 21st Show, all the links to what Amy is working on. I want to thank her, as well as Lovey Ajayi, who's the author of I'm Judging You. She's a writer and speaker. You can catch her at Awesomely Lovey, where she blogs. Thanks.
My name is no, my sign is no, my number is no. You need to let it go, you need to let it go, need to let it go.
The
21st is made possible by Custer & Bradley, LLP, providing legal service to the Urbana-Champaign community since 1895. Custer & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at CusterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and I want to extend a special 21st show welcome to those of you listening on WGLT in Bloomington Normal and joining us for the first time today. We hope you join us in the conversation on air and online. You can always find us on Facebook. Search for The 21st Show. If you have NPR One, you can follow us there, and you can find all of our information at 21stshow.org. Each Monday at this time, we'll be talking politics with a few local journalists to share what news you might have missed over the weekend and lay out the week ahead, and lots of action on both of those fronts. We had news late Friday that despite the last-minute funding for state universities, Chicago State University will be laying off about 300 employees. That's more than one-third of its workforce. Lawmakers are back in Springfield tomorrow to work on a budget impasse. There are reports that we might finally be seeing some movement this week. Joining us to talk about this from Springfield, WNWUIS, is Brian Mack. Joining us from Chicago, Gerard McClendon is the host of Counterpoint on Lakeshore Public Media and also teaches at Chicago State University. Brian, Gerard, welcome to the 21st.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Happy to be here.
Gerard, let's start with you. Chicago State is located on the far south side of Chicago, about 4,500 students. You've taught there for years, and we've read a lot about this university, but I wonder if you can describe to us what your experience is teaching there and what kind of school it is.
Oh, it's an amazing school. We're close to 150 years old. It, of course, was a teacher's college in its foundation after the land grants originating right after the Emancipation Proclamation. Predominantly African-American school, predominantly female school, and we serve a population that is just resilient and vibrant. And we do great work at Chicago State University. It's a staple of Chicago, and it's just really sad to see that a few legislators cannot remove the line in the sand that's been drawn to make sure that students get an adequate education in the state of Illinois and in Chicago.
We're going to talk about that line in the sand in a minute. But Gerard, I wanted to ask you, Chicago State ended its semester 2 weeks early on Thursday to ensure that students were able to graduate before the money ran out. This weekend, we saw, as you said, members of the African-American, predominantly the African-American community, I'm thinking in particular of Reverend Jesse Jackson, lashing out at Governor Rauner, saying, "We feel like the governor has deceived us. He's betrayed our people," saying that about Chicago State. What are you hearing, Gerard, about from other African-American political leaders about particularly the Chicago State situation and the budget impasse and the governor?
Well, we're hearing that there's just massive gridlock, you know, Madigan's not willing to bend, and then the governor's not willing to bend on union. He wants to break the unions. I mean, that's pretty obvious, and he's trying to get pensions altered. Our students were resilient. Thank God we had a graduating class last Thursday, so our seniors have graduated, which is good. But the layoffs, extremely sad. Friday, one day after the graduation day, people were cleaning out their offices. I had several knocks on my door at my office at Chicago State. Secretaries, support workers, custodians laid off. It was just a sad sight. You know, President Calhoun was thankful for the $20 million infuse that we got, but it's too little too late. You know, we'll get through the summer. Our students are still resilient. But, you know, there's, of course, talks of students transferring. There's students trying to think, should they even apply to or even accept their letter to Chicago State for the
fall? I imagine
so
that.
It's sad. It's sad.
Let's go to another campus. And, Brian, I wanted to bring you into this conversation as well. Here in Champaign, we had Governor Rauner was here at the University of Illinois last Thursday. Let's actually play the moment of him being heckled and booed by students here.
Once we get through our budget crisis in Springfield, I look forward to getting significant more funding for the University of Illinois, expanding the College of Engineering, expanding the entire footprint for the University of Illinois. It's a great institution.
A little bit of a chaotic scene there. There was lots of banging. He actually left the event a little bit earlier. There were people banging on the walls, profanities being thrown at the governor. Brian, that was Thursday. What did the governor say on Friday and over the weekend about the budget impasse?
Well, the governor said what he's often said, and that's that he's optimistic that a deal will be coming soon. He also acknowledged that fact, that he said he's been hopeful in the past, but he talked about some of these working groups that are getting together, bipartisan groups of legislators that are meeting. Of course, the big holdup has always been that Rauner insisted any final budget deal would have to include elements of his so-called turnaround agenda, which, as your other guest pointed out, includes some anti-union provisions. There are also a lot of pro-business provisions. A lot of people thought that the Democrats and the Republicans could certainly compromise on some of those pro-business provisions, but the governor has always tied it to the union weakening measures. And I think that the Democrats have just been afraid about negotiating or sort of agreeing to tie other things to the budget, because they just worry that the governor's going to continue to come back year after year and say, okay, well, in order to get the next budget, let's pass these other changes to the law that he wants to see.
I want to ask you about those business deals in just a second, but let's go back to, I want to ask you two things about these reports you said. We're hearing some reports, you just referenced them, particularly Politico Illinois reporting this morning. There are two working groups, an ad hoc committee and a so-called budgeteer committee, that are both separately working to hammer out a compromise. Brian, what do we know about this?
Yeah, so this ad hoc group has reportedly been meeting for quite some time, perhaps well into last year. And this is a bipartisan group of lawmakers that are just trying to find a way to cut through the bitterness and rancor that's coming out of the party leadership. And in fact, anytime we have seen some progress on the budget in the past, it has kind of bubbled up from the ground up.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, not from the top. No, and the top is kind of like, well, I need to find out which way my people are going so I can lead them. And they sort of run to the front of the line when it appears inevitable that they kind of
have to do that. What are we hearing from Speaker Madigan?
Well,
he had a rare appearance on Friday night too, right?
Yeah, speaking with some union leaders. Mm-hmm. But I mean, in general, the speaker has been very critical of the governor, as he has often been. Aside from he put on a good public face at the beginning of the governor's term and said we're willing to work cooperatively with him. And since then, he's been fairly polite and just, you know, saying that the governor has an extreme agenda and the speaker's contention is that it would hurt the middle class. He's taken a more sharp tone in recent weeks. We talked about that higher ed funding package that went through, a partial funding package. It gave about 60% of Chicago State's funding, as we referenced earlier. Most of the other state schools, including U of I, only got 31% of their funding. And Speaker Madigan is worried that the Republicans are sort of trapping them into what's effectively a 70% budget cut for a lot of higher ed, because we did hear the House Republican leader say, you know what, I don't know that we're going to be able to support any additional higher ed funding in the current budget year. So Speaker Madigan has remained skeptical, I think it's fair to say.
Well, and as you're talking about, apart from higher ed, and we look at where that fits into the context of the entire budget situation, the Chicago Tribune had a story over the weekend listing areas where Governor Rauner was pushing to privatize state functions. There's a new nonprofit handling business recruitment. He said he hopes to privatize portions of toll roads, ask private donors to support state museums and fairgrounds. What's the governor asking for here, and how does it fit into these broader negotiations that you were just talking about?
Yeah, well, the governor talks a lot about efficiency. So with the economic development, he says that this is how a lot of other states have done it, and you need an organization that's more nimble. It doesn't have to, you know, deal with as much of the state bureaucratic red tape that gets involved with these things. Of course, on the other hand, critics of that will say, well, you could FOIA, file Freedom of Information requests about the way the state used to do it when it was a state agency handling this sort of thing. And now it's going to be a little bit more opaque and difficult to see what exactly the state is doing to try and lure businesses here. In terms of the broader push for privatizing funding for the state museum, trying to get some sort of private way for funding to support the Illinois State Fair, I think that just fits into the governor's broader philosophy that there are some things that government ought to be doing and other things that government ought not be doing. And running a museum is something that he seems to believe government should not be in the business of doing, and thinks that, you know, there ought to be private interests supporting that. Same thing for the state fair. This is, there's the people think about the state fair, and there's, of course, concerts and carnival rides. But really, it's at its heart, it is a promotion of agriculture. And I think the governor feels like the agriculture industry could step up, perhaps, and fund that as well as individual private donors. It's just part of his broader philosophy that, I think a smaller government is what Illinois needs, and less costs from things like state workers. If you privatize some of these functions, you will need fewer government workers. That leads to fewer government union contracts, fewer pension costs.
Well, and as you say that,
line.
Yeah. So that's Brian Mackey giving us kind of the view from Springfield and particularly of Governor Rauner. Gerard McClendon, I wonder how you think that squares with what people in Chicago are thinking about Governor Rauner these days.
Well, in Chicago, there's a mixed feeling because a lot of people who voted, well, you look at Governor Rauner winning every county except Cook County, but a lot of Cook County voters voted for him as well, and they've been disgruntled and disillusioned. You know, I think here a lot of people are wondering, why should legislators get paid if their job is to pass a budget? They're wondering, how can an inept and stubborn, you know, legislator be 11 months into a year with no budget? You know, they're wanting Rauner and Madigan to chalk up their losses and move to the next year. I mean, there's billboards on the other side of the state line. Indiana has these beautiful billboards. They're blue and gold, and they say Indiana with the seal of the state of Indiana on it. It says Indiana.
Come here and do business. We have a budget. Yeah. Is that essentially what it says, Gerard?
Absolutely. Some of them say Indiana, balanced budget.
Oh, man. So, Brian, let me ask you just on that front. Apart from the budget, there's also a deadline this week for the legislature in terms of getting constitutional amendments on the ballot. Just as we wrap up here in the last couple of minutes, what's for consideration there?
Yeah, there's a number of things. One is to create a graduated state income tax. So right now, Illinois has a flat tax. So if you are, say, one of the janitors that's just been laid off from Chicago State, for example, or Governor Bruce Rauner, who made $60 million on the most recent year for which he released his tax returns, you pay the exact same flat Illinois income tax rate. What this proposal would do is say if you're on the wealthier end of the spectrum, you would pay more, a higher tax rate. If you're on the lower end of the income spectrum, you would pay less. And in fact, it's not part of the constitutional amendment itself, but one of the proposals that's kind of tied to it would result in a tax cut for the vast majority of people in Illinois, and it would only be at the very, very tippy top of the income brackets that tax rates would go up. A couple of the other proposals, there's one to eliminate the lieutenant governor's office in the future, which has been popular
We've heard that a couple times.
Yeah, that's been popular on a bipartisan basis in the past. Of course, people looked around now and thought, well, if we had Governor Rauner and no lieutenant governor, Lisa Madigan would be next in line to be the governor. And Republicans didn't like that this time around. And so they've tried to float a number of alternatives. But as you mentioned, time is running out. You have to get through both the House and Senate this week. And there's only, I believe, 3 or 4 working days scheduled this week. So there's
this
just not
week,
enough time. To,
but I know the House and Senate are scheduled right now to be at least in session. I think it's 21 of the 29 days left in May. May is traditionally when we see some action. What are your odds on whether anything will happen in the next couple of weeks?
It's always safe to bet on nothing in Springfield, as one local pundit likes to say. And that, you know, until something breaks, seems to be the safest prediction. But who knows? There's more movement now than we've seen in months and months and months. So maybe I should join the governor in being somewhat optimistic. I don't know.
Gerard, by the way, before we go, I wanted you to tell us about your new show. You're also another public media colleague. This is Counterpoint, Mondays and Fridays?
Yes, Lakeshore Public TV, Fridays, 8 p.m., Sundays, 10 a.m., news, views, controversial commentary on the issues of the day in a public forum, and we're having a great time at Lakeshore Public Media. And, you know, as Tavis Smiley, my good friend, said, you know, on public media, we don't roll like commercial media. We have the ability to try to tell the truth in a pure, unadulterated format that doesn't always have to rely on entertainment. And so I think that's the beauty of being on your show, and I think that's the beauty of all public media stations around the country.
Well, thanks for that, Gerard. That couldn't have been a better way to end this, right? Because that's exactly what we're trying to do on the 21st. That's Gerard McLennan. By the way, Gerard, I didn't ask you, do you think anything's going to happen the next couple of weeks in Springfield?
You know, I'm the king of optimism, but I'm not optimistic in the least. I don't think anything's going to move until Rauner feels that all unions are broken.
Thad McClendon, he's the host of Counterpoint on Lakeshore Public Media. I want to thank my other public media colleague from WUIS, Brian Mackey. Thanks for being with us, Brian.
Happy to be here.
Pleasure.
That does it for the 21st today. Thanks to all of you for tuning in. Tomorrow, as many campuses around the country are struggling with free speech protests and similar issues, what does free speech mean now on a college campus and who gets to decide? We're going to talk about that tomorrow on the 21st. You can always join our conversation by tweeting 21st Show. It's 21st Show. You can look for us on Facebook or NPR One on the app. You can follow us there. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for joining us. This is the 21st.